Dargrave Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2013. Lecture 14, delivered on October 7, 2013. The title of this lecture is Review for Exam 1.
Today, Review for Exam 1. This is your first exposure to one of my popular exams. It has three parts. If you listen carefully in this review and if you ask some good questions, then you'll be able to pass it with at least a D. No, with an A. Okay, three parts. First part is multiple choice. Second part is workout problems. Third part is short essay answers, short answers. And I'll go through each part in detail here. Part one, 20 questions, multiple guess or multiple choice. Some of them are math related. I might say, okay, I got a treasury, one-year treasury instrument selling at a price of $97.25. What's the yield on this treasury bill? So I'd say its price right now, its quote is $97.25. What's the yield? And I'll give you five different choices for the answer, and I'll make sure that some of the answers are what you would get if you did it wrong. I'm that kind of guy. Okay, so even if you see your answer there in the multiple choice answers, that doesn't mean it's the right answer. In this case, very quickly, you would do 2.75 over 97.25 times 100%. That would give you your answer. I will make sure that you have the answer over 100. In case you think that the payoff of the bond is the investment. It's not. That's the payoff. That'll be just one of the 20 questions. I might give you a question where I have you find the effective yield or the effective rate on a loan. So I might say that you've got a car loan that's 5.69% APR. It's a five-year car loan. Monthly payments. What's the effective yield on it? And I'll give you a series of answers. And what you would do for that one is you would do 1 plus 0.059 over 12 to the 12th power minus 1, and then times it by 100%, and that'll give you your effective yield. Notice the 5-year doesn't mean anything, matter. Effective yield doesn't have anything to do with the term of the loan.
Where did you get the
0.0569. I was just testing your ass, okay? And you did catch it. That's good. Because I was hoping no one would catch it and then I'd yell at everyone, but you caught it. Lay off. Now, as far as other multiple choice questions are concerned, well, you know, I could actually just, I've got the exam right here. I could put it up on the overhead for you to see. Yeah. Oh, okay. No, I won't. Now, there will be some questions where if you, you lend someone $1,000 and they have to pay you back in 2 years. Okay? What are you with respect to this loan? Are you the buyer or the seller? those don't even make sense. Talk to me. Are you the buyer or the seller?
The buyer.
Yeah, he's a buyer because you're buying an instrument from the borrower for the price of $1,000. Okay? You're buying it. That's what a loan is. Someone's buying it by lending you money. Okay, now, are you, what kind of a loan is this? What kind of a security is this? Is it a bond?
Sure.
yeah? What is it? Can you tell me? Is this a bond? No, it's too long. It's too short for a bond. What do you call it? Something that's between 1 and 7 years. What is it? Mumble at me. It's a note. Yes. Note. A bill is a year or less. A bond, a note is between 2 and 7 years, or 1 and 7 years. And a bond is something that's long out there. Now, what contributes to business risk? If I were talking about business risk in terms of components of a financial statement, what contributes to business risk? Stupid employees. No. financially speaking, do variable costs contribute to business risk?
Yeah.
No. Let's try this. Yeah. Fixed costs. Fixed operating costs. Say fixed operating costs, because your interest is actually a fixed cost too, but that contributes to financial risk, but it doesn't contribute to the business risk. Okay, so fixed operating costs do. And then there's one that's kind of obvious that you kind of, that sometimes I even don't mention. Sales volatility obviously contributes to your business risk. The ups and downs of your sales. Darn those customers, they don't come in when they're supposed to and consistently. So you got the sales volatility, the first thing obviously that contributes to your business risk. And then you've got those fixed costs, because you're paying those whether you have a dollar of sales or $1 million. And that's something in your own personal finance that you'll see, is that when you have the more fixed costs you incur, the riskier your life becomes, because then your income can go up or down, but those fixed costs don't move. That's things like your cell phone, your rent. You subscribe to these things like Adobe's stuff or to Microsoft 365. Those are fixed. And so they create risk for you, because they won't go down even if your income goes down. So that's one of the reasons you try to avoid those to the extent that you can, as a major exposure in your cash flow scheme. Okay. Other things I would ask you about, let's see what else I would. Know the risk premia. Remember I talked about the risk-free rate, and then there are these risk premia that sit on top of it. So if I were to say, of the three risk premia, which one would be the most significant in a home loan, in a mortgage loan? Which one would be the most significant? Can you tell me that? Nope. You didn't even try, did you? Of the three risk premia, which one would be the most significant? Yeah.
Liquidity?
No, because those things can be sold. That there is a massive, huge market called Ginnie Mae, Fannie Mae. Those things can be sold by a bank within seconds. So those are there. That's not even there. Yeah. Default risk, that was one of the two possibilities that were viable, but that's not the one that actually will be. Damn. No, don't play it. Go ahead, what is it? There you go. Give him a cookie. The reason the default premium, remember what I said, is that with home loans, you have a real asset backing it. So even if the default happens, the bank has got some physical asset that it can recover as to make itself whole. In addition, that if for any loan that's above an 80% loan to value ratio, the borrower is paying an insurance premium to cover the bank on a loss between the asset value and the loan amount. So in that case, there is a default premium. Don't get me wrong about that. But it is minimal considering all the ways the bank will be okay if you default on it. And that's not so true, though, with car loans. Because, yeah, you can get the bank will get the car back, but after what you've done to it, I mean, my God, you went to White Castle and you farted your way all the way back to Bloomington? No. That's going to make that car worth a lot less. And besides which, remember, cars lose a lot of value right off the lot. Make sure you know the components of the risk-free rate. That's always something I ask about, some way or another. And also make sure you know the capital asset pricing model. Especially in the multiple choice, know the terminology. That K sub S equals K sub F plus beta sub S times the quantity K sub N minus K sub S. Ow, that hurt like hell. God. Boy, that took the steam out of my shorts. Okay. Woman, what is K sub N minus K sub S called? Do you remember? Right off the top of your head? Know it for the exam. I'm telegraphing my punches to you. Know these kinds of things. Do you know what it's called?
I do not, sir.
Okay. Anyone, you want to try it? The expected market premium over risk-free. The expected market premium over risk-free. You remember it? Now, terminology. What is beta? It's the second letter of the Greek alphabet. Stop it. What is beta in finance? It is a metric of risk. Specifically, it is the non-diversifiable risk of the security relative to the market portfolio. The non-diversifiable risk of a security relative to the market portfolio. The non-diversifiable risk of a security relative to the market portfolio. Now let's try this. There are a couple of betas you would know right off the top of your head. You would know them off the top of your head, right? Oh, hell no. Madam, wait, you were talking to him. Why are you bothering? What is the beta of the market portfolio? Okay, let's try the definition, see if you can get it from that. Beta is the measure of non-diversifiable risk of a security relative to the market portfolio. So how much risk does the market portfolio have relative to the market portfolio?
None.
Well, okay. How much are you like you? You're like, wait, what? How much are you like you?
100%.
So, what is the beta of the market portfolio?
100%.
Or 1.00. We don't usually say them as percentages. Think about it that way. What is the risk? That beta actually tells you, just relative to the market portfolio, how much risk, non-diversifiable risk, a security has. So, if I told you that the beta of Apple is, what did the beta of Apple come out to be? Something like 0.7, what was it? 0.6 or so? Hey, it was something like that. If it's 0.60, that would mean that Apple common stock has 60% of the non-diversifiable risk of holding a market portfolio, which is our benchmark. So, in other words, if I were looking for risk as a measure, and I consider that the market portfolio is like your fulcrum, Apple would be on the inside of the risk lever. It would be less risky as far as non-diversifiable risk goes. Now, between systematic and non-systematic risk, which one can you not get a reward for? Systematic or non-systematic risk? What is it? The one you cannot get a reward for is the non-systematic, because that's the one that you can get rid of. You have gas.
Gasoline?
No, gas. I mean, now, why? And you want me to give you money for that? No! You can get rid of it. What the hell? I don't care if it's got egg in it. You know? Really. I'm not going to give you a reward because you can get rid of it, okay? But if you were to say, I've got a demon inside that's attached to my spleen, no, I'll probably give you money for YouTube for that. Just pull it out and show it to everyone because you can't get rid of it. That's a non-diversifiable risk. That's a systematic. It's in your system. The gas isn't in your system. It's just visiting you. Real problems for real people. What do we use to measure KSBF? What's our typical, the way, it's a theoretical metric, but we have something that we use that's as close as possible to it in the real world if we're pulling, trying to get actual numbers. So what is it that we would use in the real world? What is approximately the risk-free rate? Do you remember what I said about that? What do you say? You got it? No. Yeah.
A real plus the real interest rate?
No. In case of real, it plus the expected inflation premium creates risk-free rate. And let me write that down. I'm glad you brought that up because I'll probably forget that. Case of F is the real interest rate, which is based upon supply and demand of money, the opportunity cost of foregone, plus an expected inflation premium. That's what KSBF is. And it, as I said, it is a theoretical variable or parameter, if you will, but we do have something that is pretty close to it in real life. It's the yield on a short-term treasury bill, because that's as close to risk-free as anything we could possibly want. So if we're actually applying capital asset pricing model, which we do a lot, then we would probably proxy that by looking at what's the current yield on a on like a one-year T-bill. So if I ask you a CAPM problem, if you see me say the yield on a short-term T-bill is 0.75%, that should clue you. I'm probably trying to get you to use the CAPM some way. If you see me say the yield on a short-term treasury bill is, the expected return to the market portfolio is, beta for this security is, that's a dead giveaway that you're probably constructing, I'm expecting you to construct an interest rate to use for something or other based on CAPM. Know that. I do that all the time. Let's try something else here. As far as other things, I will ask you more than a few questions about the central bank, banks and banking in the central banks. One of those things that I'll do is ask you some questions, basic technical questions about the Federal Reserve. Some basic questions about the Federal Reserve. Like, for example, how many Federal Reserve governors are there? What do you say? I'm hearing calls of different numbers. Wait a minute. Excuse me. Wait. Denny's Grand Slam. Seven. And the chairman is makes for an eighth one, right? Say no. No, the chairman is one of the seven. Who's the current chairman of the Federal Reserve? Ben Bernanke. Uncle Ben. And they're putting up a... if you read my latest article at examiner.com, you'd see that they were going... There was a lot of push to put... Bernanke's term is almost up, so the president was going to put up trial balloons for a guy named Larry Summers, who is the evil of all evils, and so that's not going to work. So they'll probably... Who is the one that they are considering? Do you remember? Yeah, Yellen. She is vice chairman of the Federal Reserve right now, and she's probably, looks like she's going to be nominated, and she's probably going to be appointed, because whatever dirt is on her is also on Congress as well. Now, the chairman, all of the governors of the Federal Reserve, including the chairman, are they elected or are they appointed? They're appointed. By whom? With the advice and consent of the Senate. Excellent. Yeah, that know those. Now, I heard the number 12 come up. The Federal Open Market Committee has 12 members. The seven governors are permanent voting members. There are five voting presidents of district banks. One of those is a permanent voting member. The others serve two-year terms on a rotating basis. Which district bank has a permanent voting seat? New York. Why does New York have a permanent voting seat? Because that's where the domestic trading desk is, where open market operations are executed. So since his bank is going to be the one that runs the show on that monetary control deal, then there's most definitely he's going to have a permanent voting seat on the board. Know the three tools of monetary policy. As far as money goes, also know the three different duties of the Federal Reserve. Regulates and supervises, bank for bank, and also conducts monetary policy. And that video, if you haven't seen it yet, that's a I know a lot of you have, but if you haven't seen it yet, that little video from the St. Louis Fed is just delicious for explaining the basics of the Fed. Make sure you know how open market operations work. I will ask you about them. Now, money. Make sure you know the three kinds of money. Well, let's not talk about measures of money. I'm talking about the three kinds of money. Barter, commodity, and fiat. And also know about M0, M1, M2, and M3. I'm not saying I will, but I might ask you, which one of those measures did the Federal Reserve stop publishing? Which one was it? M3. They said no one needed it, no one used it anymore. The real reason was that it was blowing so far out of control by the middle of the 2000s that they didn't want anyone to see what was happening to our money supply. As far as money goes, make sure you know about... I'm going to give you some terms here right now. Just know the money market versus the capital market. The primary market versus the secondary market. And in general, I guess I already mentioned it, make sure you know a good construct of what would be in M1 versus what is in M2 versus what's in M3. Just make sure you know that. Oh, and M0 too. M0 is nothing but cash and currency. Just the pure fiat money of our society. That's M0. What do you remember the term I used for that M0? Yeah. I wasn't sure if I said it enough. I just kind of blew by it. It's called our base. Essentially, that's what you have. Whatever you have in your pockets, whatever businesses have in their cash drawers and in their vaults and banks, that's all the money there is if the financial system comes apart. Everything else is electronic blips that go dark. That's why for economists like me, it's interesting to keep an eye on it, because there always is the real possibility someday you're going to go to your ATM and it's not going to work. That's what a financial apocalypse is. Not to scare you, but also, as far as one more thing, that I'm not being exhaustive here, but I'm trying to give you as much wide width as I can. In the multiple choice, I might ask you about different forms of business organization. You got your sole proprietorship, your partnerships, and your corporations. Know the big 800-pound difference with a corporation. It's very important to you. There is a separation of the liabilities from the ownership. As long as you keep them separate so that a court wouldn't pierce the corporate veil, make sure you know that term. As long as you keep the funds separate, the owner's funds from the corporation's funds, that corporation is liable for its own liabilities. The bondholders, the lenders to the corporation, cannot come through the corporation to get to you as an owner. That's the corporate form. It essentially truncates the risk of corporate existence, so that we can take risks that we would never take if we could lose our own assets as well as the corporation. But with a corporation, I can't lose my own assets. The corporation could lose everything if it defaults on its debts. But there you go. But they can't get to me. Now, part two. I mean, this test is so easy, I'm embarrassed to give it to you. Really. I mean, you won't respect me in the morning. But first thing I will tell you is that tomorrow in the afternoon, and I'm not telling you when, but in the afternoon, I'm going to put up a sheet with information on it. That information would be very useful to do certain kinds of problems. If you see that information, it should tell you right away, he would be asking about this kind of thing. So I know how to do those calculations, so I should do those calculations about this kind of thing right now, and then I can put them on my card. When I come to the exam, I will have the answers. Because otherwise, you will have to try to do them during the exam, And it will be very hard to get everything done. You can still get it done if you choose to go come to the exam with them. But in your resources and materials on ReggieNet, in the class shell, you'll see just a sheet of information. And it should tell you, oh, I know what that's about, and I know the calculations I should do to prepare for that. And in fact, it will be for two problems of the four on the part two. Again, two of the two separate problems, I'm going to give you the information. You can choose to work out all the numbers that would possibly be associated, or you can choose not to. Okay? And that'll be tomorrow sometime during the afternoon. I'll open up. And then if you want to do the calculations, you'll put them on your note card. That's one of the things that I allow you to have a note card for in Formula Card, is for that. By the way, 4x6 both sides, and you're also allowed to bring in that sheet of ratios, financial ratios formula. Don't write on the sheet of financial ratios. That's just for you to bring in. Okay, now part two. I'm going to ask you to give me ratios. Maybe a current ratio, return on asset. I will also ask you for some changes. Like what was a change in sales from 2011 to 2012? What was a change in return on equity 2012 to 2013? Things like that. I will also ask you to calculate volatilities using coefficients of variation. Specifically, I will ask you to calculate a sales volatility, and then I'll ask you to calculate a business risk, and then that will give you the information to calculate the contribution of operating leverage. And finally, I will ask you to calculate the contribution of financial leverage. These are percentages. Again, I'll ask you to calculate sales volatility, reporting coefficient of variation, business risk, contribution of operating leverage to business risk, and financial leverage. I will ask you a question which is the same, different numbers, but the same as I asked you on the quiz, on the accounting review quiz, where I'll give you cost of goods sold, selling and general administrative expenses, depreciation expense, sales. You remember that one? I'll ask you a question like that. You'll have to find me my gross profit, my EBIT, my EBT, my income taxes, and my net income. Just like on the quiz. Same question, different numbers. But it looks just like it. Again, I'm not trying to throw you curveballs. I've shown you everything in the calculations part of this test. You've seen it all before. Now, the fourth one, I'm going to give you a loan, and I'm first of all going to ask you for the payments. You have to show me you can calculate the payments. Then I'm going to ask you to calculate the effective yield. And then I'm going to ask you how much money you would have to put in the bank for a certain number of years, every year, so that you would have a 10% down payment on that house described at the beginning of the problem. Again, I will ask you how much money would you have to put in every year for a certain number of years, so that at the end of the last year, you could then put a 10% down payment on this home that you want. Very practical problem, really practical kind of problem. Sometimes in finance it looks kind of like these are not practical problems. They would be if you were in that area of finance. But this is a problem that's practical for a lot of people. Okay, now I have a tradition. The last part of the exam, the first thing that I want to point out to you about answering a question of mine, I've said a lot about this before, and I'm going to emphasize it now. When I ask you a question on one of my short answer sections, first of all, you give me one sentence. You go to the second sentence, I don't read it, I just strike it out. Because the reason for that, as I've explained to you before, is that when you get out there into the business world, no one wants to read your term paper. You need to give an answer. If a boss says, what is this? Can you explain this to me? You need to be able to explain it in a short enough time that your boss won't get bored with you. One sentence, complete, spell right. Remember, I used to be an English teacher as well as a math and finance teacher. You spell wrong with me, I bring out these evil gods of the underworld. And I start eating at your flesh. So, but I'm a nice guy anyway. Okay, and also when you're answering the question, if I give you an answer, you read through all your notes, you listen to my podcasts. Don't get fancy with me with your answer. Say what I told you. That's how it's going to work in the business world too. If someone asks you, what is the answer to this? You quote the script. Don't go to Wikipedia or Investopedia or any of those other disgusting sites where creepy-ass human scum fills up their time making that website's owner rich, which is what happens with Wikipedia. You give the answer that I've given you. So if I said, for example, what is liquidity? Liquidity is the ease and efficiency with which one asset can be converted into another. That's liquidity. One sentence, what I gave you. Give it back to me. This is how it'll be in corporate for you too. Unless no one knows the answer, then you're free to ask your dog. Okay. But I emphasize this. One complete sentence. Try to be short, but sometimes a sentence has to be compound, complex, or you have a list. Be grammatically correct. Spell right, use your punctuation right. You would not believe the number of bosses, executives, who bitch at me about people's writing skills these days. It's just, I get tired of hearing about it. Don't blame me. Now I'm just going to walk around and throw out some possible questions. Some of these will be on the exam. Some of them won't. And I won't give you all of them. But I'm going to give you maybe about 10, 12 possible essay problems, short essay problems, that I could give you. The first one. What is liquidity? What are the three tools of monetary policy? What is beta? What are the three functions of the Federal Reserve? What is meant by financial intermediation? Distinguish between a sole proprietorship or partnership and a corporation. distinguish between a sole proprietorship or a partnership and a corporation. What are the three risk premia? What are the three types of currency? What is meant by shareholders have the residual claim on the assets of a corporation? What does that mean? What does it mean to say that shareholders have the residual claim on the cash flows of a corporation? Or alternatively, I could ask it, what does it mean that the debt holders have the prior claim on the assets of a corporation? A big warning to you on this one is that it's not quite correct to just say, well, if a corporation goes bankrupt, the debt holders have to be paid off first. That's what prior claim means. That's the extreme position. In general, the bondholders, the debt holders, have to be paid in a timely manner before shareholders claims can be satisfied. Now, another thing in this regard, give me a second here, try to collect my thoughts. What was I thinking? Oh! The shareholder's claim can be satisfied in one or the other of two ways. What are those ways? The shareholder's residual claim can be satisfied two ways. What are those two ways? Madam, what are they? Say it in a complete sentence and you will make me a happy man. The shareholder's residual claim,
can be satisfied through dividends or put back into the company.
Or what do we call that? Reinvestment. Yeah, we're going to have you in a financial community. You got to talk Butch. You got it. You got perfect score. See how you answer the question simply. Not simplistically, but simply, and that makes my heart warm and my pants damp. Okay? Too much information, teacher. Now, again, I didn't cover all the questions I could ask you, and some of those, they're not going to show up. I have this massive set of questions, and I roll through them, but they're all within sort of like a cabin of the important information that I've given you in the early part of this course, in the first half. I can't believe we're halfway through this course. Now it's your turn. If you ask me, you ask me something. If it's not going to be on the exam, I'll say that's not going to be on the exam. Yeah, it's like these people who come send me these email messages. They got a hold of a copy of one of my old exams, and they casually ask me exactly the question that was on an old exam, and I say, "Get off my ass, idiot." Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I could very easily do that, but most likely that would be in a multiple choice kind of an environment. And it would be something along the line of Glass-Steagall is the current law that applies to banking. True or false? What? False. It was ended in 1999. There is no comprehensive, meaningful, overlying regulatory law that can be used for regulatory purposes on banks in the United States now. That's why we are going from one crisis to another to another. And the monkeys are all having the ball, the time of their lives. That's also, by the way, if you read my article, that guy that the Obama administration wanted to appoint, Larry Summers, he was the engineer of the ending of the killing off of Glass-Steagall. He was nothing but a whore of Goldman Sachs and other investment banks and big financial banks. They wanted Glass-Steagall ended. He was the man in the Clinton administration who got it done. And he, ever since then, he's been considered a hero by the financial industry. He's been considered the architect of the apocalypse by the left and the liberals and moderate conservatives like me. That's why they floated his name and he was shot down because too many people know his dirty past. He was one of the architects of the end of Glass-Steagall. Now, on a similar notes, I'll wait, see if you want to ask that. Any other, give me questions. I'll tell you whether it's there or not. Go.
What do you know about becoming a corporation, like Form S-1?
I'll ask a question, but it will be about more, it'll be an easy question. Okay, like, for example, which is an exemption from registration? A Reg D 504, a Reg A, or an S1? Which one is an exemption from regulation? Yeah.
The
Reg D 504? Yeah, that's a Reg D. I said it the wrong way. You're right. I meant which one is not an exemption. You're right. Reg D 504 and Reg A are exemptions. S1 is a full-blown, you're doing it the right way. I could do something like, on that same vein, which of the forms would you use to obtain financial statements? 10K, 8K, both, or neither? Which one would you use, which filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission would you use to get financial statements? The 10K, the 8K, both, or neither? 10K. What is an 8K?
Non-recurring.
Just some news, non-recurring. You know, the president of the corporation was sucked up by a mothership, alien mothership, or something like that. But the 10K, full-blown. I'm glad you asked me that, because I will ask something like that. Not a heavy-duty question, but it'll be something along those lines, maybe two of them. Other questions? You eat your Wheaties before you go to bed. Don't drink. Don't have sex. And remember that tomorrow I'm going to put up on the web sometime in the afternoon in the resources and materials. It will be called Exam 1 Narratives. I'm not going to, and don't say, I just got, don't, for God's sake, don't send me an email or come to my office and say, I just got a couple of questions about what you gave us for the exam. No, that's yours. Work together, work alone, call mom, see what she has to say. Otherwise, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.